This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll spend some time talking about what is certainly one of today's most contentious issues, and that is same-sex marriage. Our guest for the program is Martha Nussbaum. She is professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago, and she will be on the campus of the University of Illinois today to give a talk in the MillerCom series, the title, Sexual Orientation and the Constitution. That'll be held this afternoon at 4 o'clock on the campus in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum. It's on South Gregory in Urbana. And as is the case with all of these MillerCom programs, they're always free. They're always open to the public. So anyone who is interested in attending the talk should feel welcome to stop by. And what we will try to do this morning is to look at some of the reasons, perhaps, that gay marriage continues to be so widely opposed, and maybe consider what a constitutionally protected right to marry might be, what that might imply, what that would mean for same-sex couples here in the United States. And of course, questions from people who are listening are welcome. We're always interested in participation of listeners. And for that, all you need to do is call us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So at any point, questions are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who call in just is that they keep their comments and questions brief, and we just ask that so we can accommodate as many callers as possible, keep our program moving along. But in saying that, I also want to make sure that people who are listening know that they are welcome. Professor Nussbaum, hello.
Hi, David. It's very good to be on the show again.
Well, we really appreciate you giving us some of your time. And I want to make sure that I mentioned that this particular topic that you're going to be talking with us about and here on the campus today, this is the subject of a book that is going to be soon going to press.
Yes, it's actually being copy-edited now, and it will be out in February 2010. It's about sexual orientation and the Constitution.
All right. One of the things that I did have the opportunity to do was I spent some time looking at a book that I believe was published back in 1999, your book, Sex and Social Justice. And there was a section in that particular book dealing with the issue of gay rights. And in there, you made this observation that you thought at the point where you were writing this that people here in the United States were a little confused, not exactly sure how they felt about the subject of gay rights, noting the fact that on the one hand, Congress felt it necessary to pass a law declaring that marriage could only be between a man and a woman, so effectively saying that gay marriage can't happen. And at the same time, there was significant support for a law that forbid employment discrimination based on sexual orientation. So we said, if you're gay, you can't get married, but you can't be discriminated against in the workplace. Do you think that today we're any less conflicted than about these issues than we were in, say, 1999?
You know, there's a big generational shift, and there's a lot of data on that. The younger people, and I think by no coincidence, it's people who've grown up knowing friends who were gay and lesbian, have a much more favorable attitude to same-sex marriage than older people, who are still able, I think of gays and lesbians as strange people who subvert the fabric of society and so on. What I'm trying to say in my book is that I think for a long time, ideas of stigma and disgust have played a very big role in this area. And what is gradually happening is that the place of those old attitudes is being taken by a much more realistic and sensitive attitude, which sees people as people and, you know, friends as friends and full-fledged human beings, and not just strange weirdos who are out to undermine American society.
Mm-hmm. I suppose I find myself thinking that same thing and wondering to what extent over time that people's feelings about homosexuality and the issue of gay marriage, among other things, partly, I suppose, for some people, their feelings proceed out of some sort of perception that there's a moral issue here. But it was always my suspicion that there was actually something else going on. And it wasn't for a lot of people, it wasn't so much that as it was some discomfort, distaste, disturbance, and you use the word disgust, and that a lot of that coming out of perhaps lack of information, unfamiliarity, that it was a real discomfort and not necessarily something that came out of a strong sort of a moral position about, what sort of sexual behavior was to be approved.
Yeah, I think this is right. Now, of course, particular religions have their own particular requirements, and we should have no objection to that. But when you have to make law about something, you have to have a reason that can be shared among people of many different religions. I'm a Jew, and Jewish law forbids the eating of pork, but on the whole, Jews don't try to make the eating of pork illegal for everyone. You know, they just follow the law of their own religion in their own way. And I think why do we think in this other area that it's different, that we should forbid same-sex marriage for everyone, even though, of course, religions differ on this and secular people differ on this and so on? And I think, you know, it can't really be explained in the end by the moral issue. That every time people try articulating that, either it's unconvincing or it just gradually betrays some deeper discomfort, as you say. Because I think the procreation thing is quite unconvincing, the idea that marriage is primarily for procreation, because, first of all, gays and lesbians have children, and they raise children and so on. But secondly, you know, we've never really thought that marriage is only for procreation. People above the age of having children can get married any time, and in fact, the Supreme Court even held that prisoners serving life terms had a constitutional right to get married, even though they would never actually physically meet their partner, because they said a marriage is about emotional companionship, and people had a right to that. So I think, you know, we don't really think marriage is just for procreation. We pull that out when we want to have something to say, and that's not the real issue.
Yeah. There seems to be general agreement that we oppose discrimination for a variety of individuals in a variety of categories, and we say that race, to the extent that we even say that there is such a thing anymore, ethnicity, religion, gender, age, all of those sorts of things, we say that people should be free of discrimination based on them belonging to or being assigned to a particular category. This is one, though, sexual orientation one seems to be one where we a lot of people have a hard time saying that that's the same situation and the same way that we think about civil rights, and the way that we apply them to people who fit into other categories. Somehow we say, no, but in this particular case, we can't quite equate those two things.
Yeah, it's true. But looking at history, there really is no reason to make that distinction. I think the closest analog to the debate over same-sex marriage is our debate over laws forbidding interracial marriage, which, of course, was forbidden and was a felony in quite a number of states until 1967, very late, when the Supreme Court threw out all those laws. Now, of course, there, too, people pulled out all kinds of moral arguments and religious arguments, but I think it's pretty clear in retrospect that what was really driving it was a feeling of disgust and contamination. I mean, I was raised by a father who grew up in the Deep South, and he told me that if you drank from the same drinking glass that an African-American person had drunk from, of course, that wasn't the word he used, then you would be contaminated. Now, if a lawyer who's a partner in a major Philadelphia firm could think that way about drinking glasses, well, surely he thought much, much worse that way about interracial marriage. And, you know, people all over just thought that was the worst kind of most disgusting and defiling and contaminating thing there was. And that's why they didn't want to allow it. It wasn't because of any real moral objection. Well, now I think we're wrestling with that same thing with the same-sex issue. And really, you know, the Supreme Court has already take a note of the irrationality of that kind of fear and worries about defilement, because in the Colorado case that overturned that referendum that made it illegal for local communities to pass anti-discrimination laws for sexual orientation, they said that the law didn't even pass the very weak rational basis test in the Constitution because it was based on what they called animus, meaning irrational fear and stigma. And the closest analog actually was a case involving people with various mental disabilities. There had been a previous case where the court threw out a zoning ordinance that didn't allow people with mental disabilities to live in a certain community. And again, they said this is just irrational fear and stigma. So I think, you know, the court has recognized this, and we're moving in the direction of change. But so long as we haven't got there yet, I think both courts and legislatures should be well aware of what they're dealing with.
Hmm. So it sounds as if you're saying that at some point, sooner or later, a ban on marriage for same-sex couples is going to end up being ruled unconstitutional?
Well, of course, the states that have done it already, the four that have had constitutional opinions based on their state constitutions, that is Massachusetts, Connecticut, Iowa, and then California, the one that was later overturned by the referendum, they've all said that their state constitutions, which are very similar to the federal constitution, make this ban unconstitutional. And they've also said that sexual orientation deserves extra constitutional protection on equality grounds. They've understood their own equal protection clauses in their state constitution to require that it be treated like gender. That is, it's a case where we have what's called heightened scrutiny of some sort. The laws have to be more than usually defended by a more than usually compelling state interest, which then they said didn't exist in that case. So you know, this has been recognized at the state level. I think it probably is a good thing if it doesn't reach the U.S. Supreme Court for a while, because federalism is a good thing in these matters. You know, we had a lot of federalism in the 19th century about divorce, and different states experimented with different divorce regimes. If you didn't like the regime in your state, you could move. And so another, there was a big difference, which was that once you got divorced in one state, then that divorce was recognized in other states. And that of course is not true for same-sex marriage, because of the Defense of Marriage Act. If you get married in Iowa, your marriage will not be legal in Illinois, and so that is a huge problem that needs to be undone. But anyway, still, the federal experiment is a good idea, because then people see what happens. And one of the things we've seen is that divorce rates do not go up. In fact, Massachusetts, which has had same-sex marriage for the longest time, has one of the lowest divorce rates in the whole nation. And actually, all the states that have adopted same-sex marriage are very low divorce states. So it's interesting. I mean, so the idea that her moral fabric is falling apart, and if we recognize this, marriage will go out the window, that idea is just not correct and not borne out by the evidence. And I think as we see what happens in the states that have it, people's fears will be allayed. Whereas if the Supreme Court simply said from on high that this has to happen, probably people would react with great fear and anger.
Mm. Well, it's certainly going back again to some of the thoughts that you laid out in this particular section of the book that I mentioned, the book Sex and Social Justice. It's certainly in the cold light of reason, one can make the argument that you say, can you argue marriage has benefits for society? Well, you'd say, well, yes. Can you argue that extending those benefits to everyone is benefit to society? I think one would have to say yes. Can you argue there is harm in denying marriage rights to same-sex couples? Again, I think one could argue yes. We can argue that there actually is harm in saying to same-sex couples that you can't. But having said all that, somehow it's difficult for us to be very rational when it comes to this conversation.
Yeah, I think you're right on all those points. I mean, obviously, the things that marriage does to provide a bunch of benefits to couples in a whole lot of areas, ranging from hospital visitation to decisions about burial to immigration to various other kinds of civil benefits, those would be good for gay families too. And it also legitimizes children. It provides a kind of safety for children. All those things are good for everyone. But you know, what people keep feeling and saying is, well, somehow this is going to make my marriage less worthwhile, or it will defile my marriage, you know. And I've tried to figure out what people really mean when they say things like that. I think it's hard to understand it. I mean, one thing they might be trying to say is, well, this is a a bogus kind of fake marriage, and if we let fake marriages into the class of marriages, then my marriage is less worthwhile. Like if we let Roger Clemens into the Hall of Fame, that would lessen the achievements of all the people who got there without using steroids. I think it's sort of that. It could be an argument like that, but the trouble is that they don't feel that way about silly, frivolous, and even immoral heterosexuals. I mean, they don't say, oh, the fact that Britney Spears is allowed to get married to somebody she's known for a day and then she gets divorced the next day, this taints my marriage. Somebody with a record of domestic violence can get married. All kinds of bad people can get married so long as they marry somebody of the opposite sex. But we never say, oh, that fact taints our marriage, so we ought to have a stringent character test before somebody could get married. So I think in the end, people have to really be thinking in much darker and more irrational terms, like that this is somehow a source of defilement or contamination to my marriage. Mm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Martha Nussbaum, she is professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. And she will be traveling here this afternoon to the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk dealing with this subject, sexual orientation and the Constitution. It's an event in the MillerCom series, and I think it may well be the last one for this semester, taking place this afternoon at 4 o'clock in the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum. Anyone welcome to attend. Questions welcome to 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. You did touch on the fact that earlier, for a long time there were state laws barring interracial marriage. I guess I wonder, though, looking back in America, was there always or how much involvement was there of the government in regulating relations between individuals, particularly when it came to marriage?
Oh, well, the state has for a long time in our history played a major role. But what I think everyone should realize is that the reality of how people lived didn't always follow that. So if we think, oh, we used to live these blameless monogamous lives and marriage was between one man and one woman and it lasted till death, that's an official story. That's a story about what the state recognized, but it isn't the story of what happened. There are some very good histories of marriage that have been produced. I particularly recommend Nancy Cott's book, Public Vows, and Hendrik Hartog's Man and Wife in America. And what they show is that all through our history, you know, people just left their spouses and they took up with someone else. But because communication was so difficult and because people could just move and lose their past, you know, no one really knew that this was what was happening. So if you moved across state lines and you just said, I'm the Widow Jones, no one did a background check to find out if your husband was still alive and you could just get married again. So our real history is a lot more checkered and a lot more human, I would say, than this myth that we used to live in this golden age of marital purity.
I'm interested in hearing a little bit more about your thoughts on the idea of the politics of disgust and how that is, and purpose not just how it shapes this particular issue, but is that something that you see in other areas as well?
Well, it's a big thing, David, in the history of law. People have always made laws against things simply because they found them disgusting or intolerable, and some legal theorists, prominent ones, have actually defended that. In England, Lord Devlin famously said that it was okay to make same-sex conduct illegal, this was in the 1950s when they were trying to decriminalize it, because the average man was really disgusted when he thought about it. And he said society needs a lot of solidarity if we're going to hang together and fight the Second World War and so on. So we need to pay attention to the disgust of the average man, and it's fine to turn that into law. Now, in America, a very prominent political figure, Leon Kass, who up until very recently was head of the President's Council for Bioethics, has taken a similar line. He wrote an article called The Wisdom of Repugnance, saying that if we feel strong disgust at something, even if it causes no harm to anyone who doesn't consent and so on, it's okay to make that thing illegal. Now, he wasn't talking about same-sex marriage officially. He was officially talking about human cloning and other things. But anyhow, it's the sort of argument that people use when they do talk about same-sex marriage. And I think it's a very bad argument, because if we look at history and we look at what that's led to, well, it's led to all kinds of discrimination against people who are merely unpopular, people with disabilities, very, very much so, and all kinds of groups in our society that are unpopular. And if we look at the history of racism in America, as I said before, I think we can't avoid now seeing that it was irrational ideas of disgust and taint. And as I said, my father tried to bring me up on those ideas, and so I know full well what they were like. And those ideas were much more powerful than any of the actual arguments that were used. Now, actually, the woman who was the wife in the great interracial marriage case that caused the Supreme Court to overturn those laws against interracial marriage, her name was Mildred Jeter. She was an African-American woman, and she married a white man, Richard Loving, a lovely name for the case, Loving versus Virginia. But Mildred Jeter Loving is still alive, and recently, on the anniversary of the case, she said that she thought that her struggle to win recognition for the love that she and Richard had is exactly similar to the struggle of same-sex couples. And she just thought people better wake up and see that when people love each other and they want to express that by making a public commitment, the state should recognize that. Hmm.
We have a caller. We'd certainly welcome others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, meaning that if it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number and we'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. We have our first caller, Champaign, line one. Hello.
I'm surprised I'm the first. Anyway, 2 points. One is, would you comment upon the notion, it seems to me that marriage, at least in the eyes of the law, is really about property rights, and access to property, i.e., between individuals, and also, you know, for medical purposes and things like that. And so that, you know, the argument that same-sex marriage is going to destroy, well, you know, what we're really talking about here is property, not much of anything else, at least in the eyes of law. And then the other is that at the end of the day, I think that the people that are gnashing their teeth and getting in such a froth about same-sex marriage, or opposing same-sex marriage, are really, I think, wasting their time, because I really doubt that any serious constitutional challenge, of course, depending on how the court, the Supreme Court may, or members of the Supreme Court may, you know, subvert the Constitution. But I think any attempt to outlaw same-sex marriage really just won't make it past the 14th Amendment through the Equal Protection Clause. Would you comment on that, please? Thank you.
Okay. Well, thanks. Thanks for the excellent questions. About property, yeah, I mean, property is part of marriage, and it's a very important part, not just property, but a whole bunch of other civil benefits, like decision rights in hospital situations, rights of decision about burial, the spousal immunity for giving testimony in court. There are a whole bunch of other things. They're not property, but they're still kind of civil benefits. But, you know, then there's also the expressive side. And when people have civil unions that have all the benefits of marriage, as was the case in both Vermont and California before the decisions that legalized same-sex marriage, it's still not the same thing. The court in Vermont pointed out that if there had been in the 60s a Supreme Court decision that said, well, you know, we don't have to have interracial marriage, but we'll create this separate thing called transracial union, and we'll give you that, but you can't have marriage, it would have been clear that that was still a racist regime. And it would have been clear even if it had all the same civil benefits. And so what same-sex couples are saying is that the benefits are not enough. There's a kind of dignity involved in the status, and we want access to that dignity on equal terms. And I think that so long as the state is in the business of giving out that dignitary status, they've got an absolutely unimpeachable argument. Now, we could all ask whether the government has any business playing this status-giving game. Maybe we should just have a regime of civil unions plus religious marriage, private marriage, you know, for everyone. But that's certainly not one of the things on our agenda right now. And it's something that, you know, theorists talk about a lot, but it's unlikely to be the way that we'll move, at least for some time. So I think so long as there's marriage that has this tremendous expressive dignity, then it's got to be given on basis of equality. Now, you ask about the court. Now, I think the court would have a hard time getting around that. They, of course, it's tricky because there are other cases that they have held that there's no right to marry, namely polygamy and incest. So polygamy, of course, there is a state interest right now, namely an interest in the equality of the sexes that can be used to argue against existing forms of polygamy. But then what if you have a case of what's now known as polyamory, that is where people you know, contract privately to have a small group who share sexual intimacy, but there's no requirement that there be one man with many wives, but it's sex equal. Well, it would be much harder to say that that's ruled out. Then as for incest, well, you know, of course, there are all the issues of child abuse, but that's one kind of incest. But what about adult brothers and sisters? Well, and, you know, there's the familiar health worries, but are they really greater than in lots of other cases where people carry genetic diseases? Well, so I think the worry is that having already said that polygamy and incest can be ruled out by law, and not being ready to go there, the court might try hard, if it's a particular kind of court, to say, well, same-sex marriage, too, is just so far from the traditional norm that it doesn't get through. Now, I think it would be a bad argument, but I can imagine courts making it, and it has been made by some of the dissenters in these state cases.
And also the caller raised the question of whether a ban against same-sex marriage is going to run afoul of the 14th Amendment.
Well, that's what I'm talking about here. I mean, what I'm saying, of course, it would be the 14th Amendment. Now, I mean, it was a question, he mentioned the Equal Protection Clause. It's actually complicated. The cases involving the right to marry cite the Equal Protection Clause and the Due Process Clause in a very complicated, interwoven way. But I think, anyway, the equal protection aspect of it does give you a very strong argument that if once marriage is allowed for one class of people, then it's just discrimination to deny it to another class of people. But as I say, that it's tricky because the constitutional law has held that bans on polygamy and incest are okay. So then the question is, where do we position same-sex marriage between those? And although I myself have no doubt which way I think the constitutional argument should go, I can imagine someone in good faith going in the other direction.
Right. We are a little bit past our midpoint here. Let me again just very quickly introduce the guest, Martha Nussbaum. She's professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. She is going to be here on the campus this afternoon to speak on the topic sexual orientation and the Constitution, which is the subject of a forthcoming book expected to be out in February of next year that she's authored, one of many that she has authored. This is an event in the MillerCom series. Anybody who would like to attend should feel welcome. This is this afternoon, 4 o'clock, in the Knight Auditorium on the U of I campus. We have some other callers here, and we'll get next to someone on our line number one, someone calling from Wilmette.
Yes. My question is, I guess my thought is, how much of this has really very little to do with the kind of subject of homosexuality and gay marriage, but a lot to do with kind of communal self-definition on the part of the evangelical right, that they've decided they're not all that sure what they believe in, but this is something they can be sure about, and it's more important to their community than any kind of objective argument out there about, you know, the very good arguments you've been giving. But that's not going to change a mind of somebody whose very self-definition and community is built up on this idea. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. I think that's a great question. I think it's like what I was saying a few minutes ago about Lord Devlin in Britain, that there's this idea of solidarity. And Devlin was basically saying, well, you know, whether it's good or bad argument, if people think it's very important to communal solidarity, we have to honor it. Now, of course, I'm saying we don't have to honor it, but you're asking, is that what it's about? I think that's part of what it's about. I think that, you know, sure, the evangelical community has long been looking for issues to bring people together and bring out intense political activity, and this is one that seems to work. But it's not, of course, only evangelicals. There are a lot of different groups, obviously, the Roman Catholic Church, not necessarily its members, but the hierarchy of the church has been very active here, and so too has the hierarchy of the Mormon Church, which funneled huge amounts of money into the campaign against, for the repeal of same-sex marriage in California. So not all of these have exactly the same need of solidarity, I think. Actually, it's a loser for the Catholic Church because Catholic lay people are much, much more tolerant than the hierarchy. I mean, it's been known for a long time on the campuses of Catholic universities that they've tried hard to have non-discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. Notre Dame, at one point, the faculty voted something like 95-2 that they should have non-discrimination on grounds of sexual orientation. But it was then the hierarchy, the administration, the trustees, and the church hierarchy that stopped that from happening. So I think it's really very, very complicated. I think with Mormons it's harder to tell whether there's a shared sentiment because there is a great deal of solidarity anyway within the Mormon community, and there's a tendency to kind of push to the margins anyone who doesn't share the dominant position. But anyway, there are all these different groups involved. It's very hard to tell how the evangelical need for solidarity figures here. And I think it's going to figure less and less as time goes on, because I think ultimately for evangelicals, as for Catholics, they're going to see it's a loser because young people just, you can't get them to hate their classmates. They just won't do it. And you can't get parents to hate their children. And this is something that, contrary to what they often say, you can't teach people to be straight. If your kid is gay, your kid is gay, and you're not going to hate the kid on that account. So I think over time, as more and more people come out in those communities, it's going to prove to be a loser.
Next, we'll talk with someone back here where we are in Champaign. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a comment and a question. Dr. Nussbaum, I really appreciated what you said about people with disabilities. When my husband and I got married, I was 47. He was 52. We each of us had two graduate degrees, and my aunt said, "You can't get married." And about the other, what I'm wondering is, if you had civil unions instead of marriages, would that mean these gay people couldn't get Social Security or widow's benefits or anything like that?
Okay, yeah, thanks very much. No, the whole history of disability and marriage is a terrible one, because there have been high-ranking judges who have defended a eugenic program that denied marriage rights to people with disabilities. And that's a very ugly part of our history that by now I hope we've thoroughly repudiated. But
I'm going to
Hang
up and listen on air, okay?
Right, yeah, thank you for the question.
But about benefits, well, states have crafted these civil union deals differently from state to state. Some of them don't get all the same benefits. I mean, most of them get Social Security and some of those benefits. But actually, more and more, the state civil union deals give very much all the same benefits as marriage. And as I said, Vermont and California, that was the case, that they had exactly the same civil benefits. But what was lacking was the full dignitary status of marriage. The Illinois bill that's currently under consideration, I mean, I want to mention that there's a resolution that's pending here to have civil unions for same-sex couples in Illinois. That gives benefits equivalent to those of marriage. And so that's an important step. It's an important first step. But what people, I think, quite rightly feel is that it's still unequal. It's still a lower status. You're being denied something that other people have.
All right, again, let's go to another caller here. This is someone in Urbana. Line number three.
Hello, Professor Nussbaum. You resort to disgust as an explanation for opposition to same-sex marriage because the other arguments seem not to hold water. I'm wondering if you have explored the phenomenon of disgust and its foundations and could talk about that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, yes, actually, this is lovely because I actually wrote a whole book on that in 2004, so now I get to talk about that. I wrote a book called Hiding from Humanity, Disgust, Shame, and the Law. And so, yeah, one of the things that inspired me to write that is that there's some new research about disgust that's very, very interesting. We used to think that disgust was just a gut reaction and it had no thought content. But there's a lot of psychological research now, particularly by Paul Rosen from the University of Pennsylvania and Jonathan Haidt, his colleagues, that shows that disgust actually has some ideas in it. That is, your conception of the thing that you're smelling or touching or something plays a very important part in whether you're disgusted by it or not. And so what they conclude is that at the heart of disgust is the idea of contamination. You think that if you touch or take in something, then you're going to be defiled by it. And that that idea of contamination is bound up in turn with a fear of our own animality and mortality. The so-called primary objects of disgust are things that are just animal fluids that we have, or feces, bodily fluids of various kinds, and the corpse. So that's the kind of core of disgust. But then what happens is that people in all societies, although in different ways, they project it outwards onto groups of people. So in other words, in every society, there are some people who will be identified as smelly, slimy, in some way contaminating. And of course, it won't be based on fact. It'll be a projection of some kind. And what's the function of that? Well, in my book, I argue that it looks like the function is it's not enough to distance ourselves from our own bodily waste products, but if we can have a group of humans to serve as a boundary between ourselves and our own animality, we're that much further from being animal and decaying and mortal ourselves. So it's kind of irrational. I mean, my title, Hiding from Humanity, that's what it is. And that means that it's a particularly irrational emotion, and I think it's one that is particularly unworthy of being involved in the legal process. It may be that it's, we all have it in some form, and all societies have it in some form, but it doesn't give us good reasons for making something illegal.
I think it's a very interesting notion that there should be a thought component to this business of disgust, because I think, as you say, I think it's one could understand the idea that it was a gut reaction, because we do seem to have gut reactions to so many things, and yet at the same time, I think it's very interesting to try to take that apart and say, well, but there actually is a thought component to that, and there should actually be some sort of deeper reason behind what we think of as simply being an emotional sort of physical reaction.
Yeah, it is very interesting because they did a lot of experiments where they have the same smell and then they tell you different things about what the smell comes from, and they found that people had totally different disgust reactions. For example, if they're told that it was cheese, that was okay, but if they were told that it was feces, it was disgusting. So, in a variety of ways, they established that it does rest on your thought, and of course, we know that it's learned. I mean, children learn it in the process of toilet training. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't have an evolutionary component, and I think probably the reason that we evolved as creatures who easily form disgust reactions towards feces, corpses, etc., is that that was useful evolutionarily. It doesn't map on perfectly to the sense of danger, and the experimenters show that. I mean, there are lots of dangerous things that we don't find at all disgusting, and then there are many disgusting things that are far from dangerous. And so they would give people a detoxified cockroach sealed in an indigestible plastic capsule, and the person still wouldn't eat it. Although, on the other hand, some quite dangerous foods, they didn't find, like, mushrooms of certain kinds, they wouldn't have found those disgusting, although they might be afraid of them. So that disgust doesn't really track perfectly the sense of danger, but probably in evolutionary times it was a pretty good proxy. So, I mean, yesterday I took the cap off the milk in my refrigerator and it smelled really disgusting, and I threw it out. I didn't bother to do a bacteria test, you know, so it might or might not have been spoiled, but it's probably a pretty good thing to follow that instinct in certain situations. So I think that's why we have it. But, of course, that doesn't mean that the further move that consists in projecting these disgust properties onto a group of people, it has anything to be said in its favor.
Yeah.
No, I think people do that to protect themselves, and so we can understand why they do it, but that doesn't mean that we should honor that.
Another caller here, someone calling from the campus, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to suggest for your consideration the possibility that all couples that want the rights that are now associated with marriage should have a civil union. And as a matter of fact, I think we have a civil aspect to all the marriage ceremonies that take place. And if everybody would recognize and require that, whether or not you have a religious or some other basis for marriage, wouldn't matter. We'd all have the same rights, regardless of the gender makeup of the couples. Is that a possibility, Professor?
Okay, thank you very much for that question. Actually, as a matter of kind of ideal social thought, I agree with you in the sense that if we were planning things from the beginning, I think it would make much more sense to figure out what civil benefits we would give to certain kinds of couples and then give it to them all and forget about this business that the state is conferring sanctity or dignity on certain unions. That's rightly the business of private groups and religions.
But how can the state confer sanctity?
Well, I mean, people think they do that, and there is this perceived difference between marriage and civil unions. That's what I'm talking about. And so that expressive aspect, I think, maybe isn't the business of government in the beginning. But look, now that we've got it, the question is, if a state, let's say Illinois, said, well, you know, we're going to get rid of marriage now. We're going to have only civil unions. Because we don't like the idea that these same-sex couples are going to keep on agitating for their for more than a civil union. See, that would be not just bad, but it would be unconstitutional, just in the way that, you know, some southern states closed all the public swimming pools when they saw they would have to integrate
right.
them. And one region of Virginia even closed the whole public school system when they saw they would have to integrate. So if you close down a benefit because you fear the integration of it, that is unconstitutional. So we, you know, if we were starting from the beginning, it would be a different question. And if we were starting from the beginning, I would actually want to go one step further than you go. I would want to say, well, why do we want one bundle in the first place? Maybe decisions about hospital visitation should be made by one group of people, and benefits for sharing a household should be given to another group of people. And some France has gone some degree in that direction by thinking of the household as something that could be shared by people who aren't having sex with each other. So, you know, that more thorough rethinking would probably be good, but I don't think we're going to do that anytime soon.
No, too complicated. I agree. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Martha Nussbaum. She's a professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. She'll be here on the campus a little later today at 4 o'clock to give a talk in the MillerCom series, the topic Sexual Orientation and the Constitution. Anyone welcome to attend, and questions welcome here too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. You know, as the caller posed the question, I found myself wondering, well, given that for a marriage to be legally recognized, certain things must be done, and that in a sense a religious ceremony is optional, isn't that what we already have, that in fact all couples, those that are legally permitted to marry, do have a civil union, and that the religious part of it is kind of up to them?
Well, you know, what I think is that what we have is something very confused. Because on the one hand, sure, it's just a bunch of civil benefits, you could say, and actually we make it very easy for people to get married. I mean, we give them a license at the drop of a hat. We also make it very easy for someone to perform a marriage. There are some states in which any private citizen can get a license to perform a marriage if they do it only once a year. So we don't think that it's that big a deal, and we leave, the big deal for the religions. But at the same time, we do. I mean, obviously, people attach a lot of emotional importance to the idea of marriage. It's precisely for that reason they want to deny it to same-sex couples, even though they are happy with the idea of civil unions for same-sex couples. And so marriage, you know, does and doesn't have this connection to dignity and status. And as long as there's that ambiguity, and as long as most of us, most Americans do think that marriage means something more than just the benefits, then it's discrimination to deny it to same-sex couples.
I hope you'll forgive me for launching into a topic at this point that is probably way more complicated than we can talk about it in 5 minutes. But I do find myself thinking about the very idea of rights, and you know, the question of, well, who has them, where do they come from, and then depending on how you feel about that, then what you think about the idea of discrimination. Is it possible to say in brief something about that idea of where rights come from and who we think have them?
Well, I'll say something about what I think. It's not what, you know, there's a lot of dispute about this, but I guess I think really that it's something about our humanity and our human dignity that's the ultimate basis for rights. That is to say that a nation that doesn't recognize them legally is doing something wrong, because there's something about people that leads us to think that they're worthy of certain kinds of lives, lives that are somehow commensurate with the dignity that they have as human beings. And, you know, we've also, in the modern world, I think it's inevitable the government has to play a very large role in securing those rights. So any government that doesn't do that is failing to recognize something that powerfully exists. Now, I don't mean to say that I think only humans have rights. I actually believe that animals have certain rights also. But in any case, that's a minority position. But I do hold that. But human beings have rights that are closely related to the kind of characteristics human beings have. And so I would say, you know, an elephant has no right to a liberal education, for example, because it doesn't have those kinds of capacities that would make that a good for it. But human beings have a variety of different capacities, and if we think about what capacities they have and which ones, you know, which ones seem to be closely related to the very idea of a life that's worthy of human dignity, then I think we come out with an idea that all human beings ought to have certain opportunities protected for them by the government in which they live. And that's what I've been working out for a number of years. But in any case, in our society, we don't have to go there, because we have a constitution, federal constitution. Each state has a state constitution. And sometimes the state constitutions do better than the federal constitutions in areas like education. I mean, there's no federal right to education. So a state that didn't have any public education would not be violating the U.S. Constitution. But lots of state constitutions say this is required. It's part of our constitutional entitlement. So, you know, we have all these legal documents that spell out those rights that we have. And so even if we don't agree about where rights come from, we have agreed to put it down on paper that there are such rights and that everyone has them.
Yeah, although I suppose one would have, this is not a particularly important observation on my part, but I guess one might have to observe that, yes, we had this piece of paper and it said that when we originally wrote it down, but then sometime later we had to add on, say, oh by the way, we mean for black people too. And then we had to put down on there, oh by the way, we meant this for women too. So it's something that we continue to work on, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one way of thinking about that is that we've changed our view. But I think the better way of thinking about it is that, you know, our judgments of who belonged in that class were just hasty or prejudiced or heedless, but that the basic idea of the founding documents was a good one. And, of course, even then, plenty of people had the thought that African Americans were really human too. It's just that that position was a minority position at the time, and or at least not enough people held it to get it into the Constitution. And so, you know, we keep trying to be more honest with ourselves and to not dishonestly deny the recognition of full humanity to people we live with and exchange citizenship and ideas with. And I think it is an ongoing struggle. And, you know, this is the latest. My book was called, a recent book of mine was called Frontiers of Justice. Like, where is the frontier in this struggle to recognize full human entitlement? Well, there I focus particularly on the struggle to extend full civil rights to people with disabilities, because I think that's one of the frontiers. And I do also think our struggle to recognize the needs and the entitlements of people in other countries is another one of those frontiers. But anyway, certainly this struggle right here and now to extend full dignity and recognition to people of sexual same-sex sexual orientations is a major frontier, and I think we are finally beginning to confront it.
Yeah, and yet, though, I guess we'd have to say that, as with these other things, that it's a journey that goes step by step, and it's not something that, and it's never been something that has happened really quickly.
No, but you know, I think that with this issue, as with disability, there's one great advantage, and that is the relation of parent and child. Race is, in a way, harder, I think. It's at least because there are judges who just, you know, they might never have known an African-American person very closely. And so, but people have children who have disabilities, and people who have children also have children who are gay and lesbian, and people love their children. So I think that's one route through which these issues do make progress, that once people feel that their own child deserves to be treated equally with everyone else, then it's very much harder for them to deny it to other people's children.
Mm. Well, we're going to have to stop at that point. Again, before we go, with the mention that our guest, Martha Nussbaum, will be here on the campus of the University of Illinois today to give a talk on the topic Sexual Orientation and the Constitution. That's a focus of her most recently completed book, something that will be out next year. She's the author of a number of books having to do with law and legal issues. She's professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago. The program today takes place at 4 in the Knight Auditorium. That's in the Spurlock Museum on South Gregory. It's an event in the MillerCom series. It's open to anyone who is interested in attending. And Professor Nussbaum, thank you very much for talking.
Oh, thank you so much, David. I really enjoyed it, and all the callers, too.